brought to you by the Computer History Museum.
Welcome to From the Archives of the Computer History Museum. I'm curator Chris Garcia.
At 101 years of age, Arnold Spielberg is one of the last remaining members of the first generation of computer pioneers. Known for his work at RCA and General Electric, Spielberg is most proud of his work inventing the point-of-sale system. Spielberg was instrumental in designing the Bismack at RCA, and later the GE-225 for General Electric. In this 1988 oral history with Gardner Hendry, Spielberg recounts his early work in electrical engineering.
I graduated in high school in 34, would you believe?
Yeah.
That's a long time ago.
Okay,
and,
yeah.
During the Depression, so I went to work in a small department store down in Kentucky, starting off as a stock boy and clerk, and spent a total of about 7.5 years in that business. And the last 2 years, I was a manager of one of the stores, and during the course of that experience, I learned a merchandising game, since it was a general category of department stores, a la JCPenney's. You know, mm-hmm. That's ilk, you know,
yeah, that kind
that
of
class
thing.
Of merchandise. And so I had experience in buying, selling, trimming, ordering, bookkeeping, checking up, the whole bit.
Marking down, sales.
The whole merchandising thing, including trying to come up with some ideas to improve our profitability, like developing good stock record recording methods so that we could literally track the merchandise and what was sold and what wasn't selling, and then use that information to plan buyings for the next season. And it was successful. It improved profitability in some of the departments that we tried it in. Anyway, after a stint of almost 4 years in the service in the Air Force, which included about a 9-month stay at Wright Field, in which I developed a receiver to guide a bomb down called Raison. You know, I mean, as I was a ham radio operator, so that was what I got when I came back from India, and I was stationed in India. I got stationed at Wright Field through a little help, and got in the development lab. And so one of the projects I got was to design a small receiver about 8 inches by 8 inches by 4 inches to fit in the tail of a bomb and use and receive signals to guide the bomb down by flipping the ailerons that were the fins of the bomb. So following that, I decided to go to college and went to University of Cincinnati and then went to RCA. So that gets me into this beginning of computer development. My first experience at RCA were in the circuit development, primarily on the military programs, LeShoran, and I worked on early magnetostrictive delay lines in the early days for all sorts of different times, and I worked on a version of Shoran that was supposed to be high resolution Shoran, and my approach was to try to find a way of capturing the Shoran pulse and differentiating the peak of the sine wave and using the crossover where it crossed zero, because the differentiation changes the thing from a peak to a crossover, and use that to amplify and try to get 50-foot accuracy at 100 miles. I mean, we never quite got it with that method, but mm-hmm. it was a good experience. And then when the computer started RCA, I moved into that, doing early work on circuit development, trying to choose which logic system we should eventually build at computers. I worked at that time for Art Beard, but in conjunction with Art Beard, because I reported to a different manager. But I eventually ended up working with Art Beard. And then when Bismack was formally started, I moved into the 598 and began working. At that time, I was promoted to a leader, the old RCA leader.
Could you just, I mean, you told me earlier about some of the strange things some of the things that were you considered for logic when you were working on that.
Working in 591, there was about four or five of us working on circuit development, And one of the things that I was charged to do was to investigate the use of logic tubes. And RCA had developed a tube they called the Additron, which literally took three inputs and tried to give you a sum and a carry. And we investigated that tube and came to the conclusion that while it was a clever idea, it was a very fragile device and not very stable, and that was eliminated. And then we investigated using twin triodes with a common cathode for a NOR circuit by tying the plates together and using inverted signals on the grid to give you a positive output, or a positive signal on the grid to give a negative output. And we made NOR circuits out of that, and I built a little vacuum tube adder out of that, and did a whole bunch of circuit development at that time, then worked on magnetic logic. The goal was to try to use no diodes even in the magnetic logic, to see if you could make a magnetic shift register with absolutely no back isolation, which a diode would provide. Mm-hmm. And we never could quite make it work, you know. So we had to give up and say we'll use diodes. And then in the magnetics, then we had a sort of informal but semi-formal contest as to what circuit system to ultimately use. This was all a predecessor for Bismack. And after trying like hell to make magnetics work, we gave in to the diode logic because it was just ultra simple comparatively. At that time, we developed our own pulse transformers because nobody had them that you could buy. So I remember designing pulse transformers, designing various kinds of driver circuits, you know, the whole bit that built up the logic family. And my initial work was on the Bismack arithmetic unit. And we did the first Bismack arithmetic unit, which was done in parallel, two complete arithmetic units. And then we compared the results by complementing one side and resetting a register to zero, you know, because they're So that All was right. The way we tried to put accuracy in there.
Now, didn't Bismack try to carry parity through everything?
Yes.
And then when it got to the arithmetic units, they didn't know how to carry parity.
That's right. So they did duplicate adds with a comparison check.
Yeah, okay.
And the other thing that I got involved in subsequent to that was the system design. And as you know, one of the things that Bismack had was tapes and stations. They had 250 tapes. This is for the OTAC, Tank and Automotive.
Yeah, I remember the tapes.
And Ralph Montillo is the guy who did a good tape design. They used to weigh tape, you know, to get the to trip an arm that caused a servo to take it up. So they have tapes and bins. When it weighed enough, it tripped an arm, and the servo would grab it and wrap it back on the reel.
Mm-hmm.
So that was our sort of a bang bang servo. And I got involved in a overall system design, which included helping to define the sorter. And Charlie Hobbs worked on that, if you remember Charlie Hobbs.
Yes.
And he did the first design of a sorter, and I ended up doing the final design. But before I got on that, I was involved in the system central work. And a fellow by the name of Mo Atel. Do you remember Mo?
No, I don't remember Mo.
He was a pretty sharp engineer. We worked together, and we came up with what we call the scheduling unit. And the idea of the scheduling unit was to be able to selectively switch the appropriate tape through a crossbar switching network to the right trunk, or to the right input or output of either a sorter or the computer or a printer. And our scheduling unit was designed to be pre-programmed with punch paper tape that would then literally automatically do the day's work. You would say there's going to be so many transactions, you'd calculate the number of transactions. When you get an end result, it was supposed to come back to the scheduler and say, now you can shift the tape to an output or to a sorter to sort the data or what have you. But Brustman was a little too suspicious of trying to do everything automatically, so they ended up doing it manually, and they had dual operators who would literally follow a paper program, which was a daily schedule, and the two guys had to press the same switch, and it wouldn't cause the action until both operators pressed the switch on separate consoles, and then they mutually completed the circuit and said that transaction can take place.
Redundancy
at the operator level.
Exactly.
Yeah. And the other thing that I worked on was a lot on analyzing whether we should have read after write on the tape, and we did that. And then I came up with a patent on sampling the current through the head of the write head to verify that the signal in fact went through the head, because they're always burning out heads.
Okay.
And that patent was known as the Rivas Spielberg patent, and it gave IBM and a lot of other people problems because it was a very fundamental patent in error checking on tapes. So I did a lot of work in systems there, and then as ended up on the sorter, and we did completely re-logic design the sorter after Charlie and the people worked on it, and we found that in the first pass of designing the sorter, that nobody thought to buffer the data as being transferred from one tape to another. As a result of that, no tape ever ran the same. The densities were different on tape, and you would end up, after about three passes, you would fall out of sync, and it wrote garbage on the next tape. So at that point in time, they realized they had to put a buffer memory in there. Then they became concerned about limiting the size of the messages. So we ended up limiting the message size, I think it was 512 characters. I can't remember this for sure.
Yeah.
But they put a memory in
to
take care of that. And that allowed you to have as many passes as you needed to sort the data, because they sorted by progressive strings of two.
Okay.
And that was another, I think Charlie came up with the idea of the progressive strings of two, which meant when you read one tape, you literally kept using that data on tape as long as the next message was larger in sequence. And whenever it broke to a lower ordered number, you stopped that tape and started the next tape and took its sequence. And then you then did select, select, merge, then create, use that, and that only gave you a partial sort. And on the next pass, you built a bigger string and a bigger string and a bigger string.
And you just kept taking passes.
Yeah, taking passes till you finally sorted the entire tape. Yeah.
Okay.
They didn't have enough memory or use a computer to sort like they do nowadays.
Okay.
It was a hardwired machine that sorted, merged, extract. I think you remember that, don't you?
Yes, I remember the sorter. Yes.
Yeah. And John Page.
I never knew how it worked. Though.
Yeah. Okay. John Page did most of the logic design. He was a mechanical engineer that decided to become a logician. Had a real sharp mind and a good memory. Did a good job on it.
Mm-hmm.
After that was over, became a what's the next level after leader, department manager, I guess.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, there were group leaders and then department managers.
Yeah, I became a department manager and was put in charge of this new program that, in the meantime, this marketing people had sold the Associated Merchandising Corporation, a BizMac, and agreed to develop a point of sale system.
Okay.
The specifications were rather crude and not well defined, and one of the first jobs that I had was to find out just what the hell we should build. And I put a small team together, and I got some good people on the program. And Irv Cohn joined me as the leader of logic design, and John Baer was a leader of mechanical design. And we had a couple of programmers. And well, they didn't come till later. And the first thing we did, literally, was build a mock-up of what we thought a crude but the demonstrable point-of-sale system might look like. We built a mock-up cash drawer. We made it look as real as possible. I even have a picture of it, I think, at home.
Okay.
And we built it by getting an old cash register that we bought from an outfit in Philadelphia that was going bankrupt. Not a cash register, I'm sorry, an adding machine.
Yes, okay.
So we used the adding machine to simulate the printer and the logic of creating a sales check. And we designed a crude 10-key keyboard, which was the prototype of a power actuated one that I described here, which I will describe later.
Okay.
And let's see. We then took this on the road to about five of the major department stores in the Federated and Associated Merchandising Corporation's chain. The first we went to was Rich's in Atlanta. And we set up a mock-up sales operation in a small training area, and we literally had the clerk sell merchandise and punch up the keys, even though it was not like a real cash register, but the idea was to simulate what we thought might be a good design and then take elaborate notes of their criticisms and comments. And one of the first things that came out was how slow the printer was.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never quit being slow. You know, even today's machines are still too slow. And the other thing we dealt with a lot was how much time should a clerk dwell at a cash register to complete a sale, finishing up so that she could get back on the floor and sell again. And those were the days when clerks did the selling instead of nowadays where you go pick your merchandise and take it to the mm-hmm. counter.
Yep.
So there was a concern about how many clerks and how many customers could be serviced in a given period of time by a machine.
Mm-hmm.
So the whole idea was to make minimal key and strokes to input the data, the fastest possible printer we could come with, all calculations would be verified, that sales tax would be calculated, discounts would be entered, and all these were notes that we took as part of that became a ultimate specification. We went from Rich's to Shillitoe's in Cincinnati, to Reich-Kumler in Dayton, to what was the name of the store in Columbus? I can't remember, but it's a significant store in the Federated chain, to Filene's in Boston. I think we covered those stores with a team that took us about a little over 2 months to make this research. Then we spent another couple of months writing the specs up. And then we passed them by product planning. And then we passed them by AMC. Clarence Pippinger was their technical representative.
Mm-hmm.
And then we began design. And I remember scoping out the program as about a 2.5, 2.75 year program. But because of all the delays and all that, top management said you will do it in 2 years or something like that. It was a very difficult task, but I loved it too much not to say no, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So we designed the thing, and there was a lot of interesting things that came out in that design. Some of the highlights of the specifications were that we would be able to read merchandise tags. We had to make a choice between the parallel reading and serial reading. And since almost everything we knew how to design was serial, we chose the, who the heck's tag is it now? Darn, I don't remember the name of the tag, but it's the kind that you see on a garment where the code is read down the tag.
Okay.
And there was another tag that the red code was read across the tag.
Mm-hmm.
And it was in two segments. There was 2 4-character sections. We put a parity bit on the four bits and made it 5 bits, so we would have the ability to check parity of the incoming data.
Now, you weren't reading code. You weren't reading human-readable digits.
No, we were reading punched holes.
Punch holes. Okay.
And we designed a tag reader that would read both the tag and read a credit card. Now, I'll describe the credit card. The credit card was the old dress graph, multigraph, embossed metal thing with a piece of plastic on the back of it, which you could thumb out, that had a little detent that caught at the end, and about an inch and a quarter of it stuck out, and that would slide into the machine on some locator holes that would fit on pegs. It would be dragged into the machine. Pins would sample, you know, and step along, tick, 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 tick. And at each stepping point, pins would go through the holes, and, you know, a typical way of reading, an old-fashioned way of reading punch holes. And so that would allow you to enter your own ID number from your credit card, and thus we were able to handle charge sales. And when you hit the keyboard, you would identify whether you were dealing in a charge sale or a cash sale. You would identify whether you were allowing a discount or not, because the person may have been allowed some discount. It would calculate sales tax, and the sales tax for the particular locale would be entered as part of the data. The tag reader would take the tag, the merchandise tag, and after it read it, drop it into a box. So you had every tag that you read was saved in a box.
Mm-hmm.
So that you could, if you want to, you could have a reconciliation at the end of the day. So we not only didn't trust the electronics, we wanted to make sure we captured the tags as well.
Yes.
The whole angle was to try to put as much safety as possible. I'll describe the central processor later. The logic of the cash register was a relay logic. We used Western Electric type relays because we thought they were about the best. We used one small piece of vacuum tubes and thing. We used some thyrotrons. That was the circuit drive, the drive to drive the signals back over the lines. And our spec were we had to be able to send signals back over 500 feet. okay. To the central process, the recorder center, we called it. And the idea was that in order to verify that data, you would send the signal back. It would be copied onto the drum. On the next revolution of the drum, it read the signal. It transmitted it back over the line where it was decoded, and it fired off the printer, which was a combination printer and display unit. Mm-hmm. The printer wheel was a disc with the characters embossed on the end. Half of the circumference was embossed characters for printing. The other half of the circumference was a display of the characters in
that was 180 degrees away from it.
Yeah, okay. That's right. And so the paper was fed from the bottom, and so when it printed, the character was at the bottom, and 180 degrees away was a window where the appropriate numeric was displayed. So you can literally look at the setup across the window and verify that you actually had transmitted the character that had come back and given you the same character that your finger pushed. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to take the time to verify everything, you could literally verify. So it was a complete loop, closed loop verification system for entering data. Mm-hmm. And the drum was divided into sectors. And for each track on the drum, you could store the data from 10 point of sale units. And there was elaborate timing schemes. There was marker pulses and clock pulses, and you can't imagine, yeah. You know, to time this damn thing out. And in order to store data on the drum, we had a great big drum designed by Bryant.
Yes, I remember
Warm Lake, Michigan. Yeah,
exactly.
And it was probably the biggest drum they ever built. It was about 14 inches in diameter and about 20 inches long. And it spun at about, 1,800 RPM or something, yeah. Like that. I can't remember exactly what. But
remember how much it stored? Did you have?
Yeah, let's see. I think about 20,000...
character.
No, 20,000 segments of information.
Okay.
A segment would consist of the stock number, the price, the season, and a few other pieces of data that I don't recall.
All right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
And the tracks were addressed by a hashing scheme that in which we took the stock number and added it to itself and then divided it by the number of tracks on the drum, and the residue was the address of the track that the data was to be put on. So when the lookup did the same decode as the storing methodology. So when you entered data into the system to build your database, you just fed in every stock number, key inputted it. Matter of fact, we took one of the sales recorders and used it as the key input device. We took the keyboard portion of it to be an entry device.
Mm-hmm.
Beside the FlexWriter, which was the computer console.
Yes. Yes, I remember FlexWriter.
IO device, yeah. And so that hashing scheme worked pretty good. And just to make sure we didn't overflow, if you couldn't find the data on that track, you automatically switched to several surplus tracks, which were designed to hold overflows.
Mm-hmm.
And based on the known accommodation of the drum, we figured we could fill the drum to within about 95% of its maximum capacity without a danger of overflow because our hashing scheme was pretty flat.
Mm-hmm.
It got a fairly good distribution of the data across the number of tracks that you had. So that was the logic of the drum. And that was an early thing. I never heard of anybody that had that scheme at that point in time.
You know, who thought up?
A combination of Irv Cohn and Felipe Tanco. I think Irv came up with the idea, and Felipe proved it mathematically. He just worked on it and did all sorts of analyses on it until he showed that with an ID of the size of a stock number, and then we had to dictate to the stores some stock numbers. We said you cannot have less than 8 digits for a stock number.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes.
So that's in order to get the right distribution. We knew that was many millions of combinations, and that was going to be flat when we had to only store 20,000.
Yes. Okay.
So that was part of our restrictions on the thing. And they protested a little bit about that, but they eventually bought into it.
Mm-hmm.
The machine logic was rather straightforward. It was basically a single address drum computer with a small buffer memory of about, I think, 16 character buffer. There was an additional buffer associated with the the read-write portion of the sectors relative to the data coming back and forth from the point-of-sale units. Our program called for only building 10 point-of-sale units. We actually ended up building about 6.
Okay.
There was more in process by the time they were stored, but I think they installed in Higbee's ultimately with about 5 or 6. They may have added more, but I'm not sure, Gardner.
Mm-hmm.
The decoding, logic decoding scheme was a combination of fixed hard logic and microcode. Microcode in our terminology now, in those days it was a diode matrix, where the matrix was addressed by the instruction, and the diode selected heated up the gates that were supposed to route the data. And in order to do, say, multiplication or multi-step instructions, we had what was known as an S counter, which was programmed to step along based on the instruction, instruction decode, into a stepping sequence, which would do repeated additions and shift for multiply, with appropriate steps for transfer, shift, store, and all that kind
mm-hmm.
of stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. All right.
So that was a fairly early quasi microcode machine.
Mm-hmm.
It was slow as molasses, as compared to today's machines. This thing was made of 13 racks, if I remember correctly.
Oh.
6 foot high.
Size.
Huh?
Yes.
13 racks, 6 foot high. The arithmetic unit took one whole rack. And we also used a dual arithmetic unit.
Okay.
So we copied that idea.
Same idea from Bismack,
yeah.
Yes.
And wherever we could. We had a different circuit system than Bismack. We had a lower cost circuit system. It was one Chuck Propster came up with.
Mm-hmm.
He had come up with a flip-flop using only two tubes, and he derived the output of the flip-flop from the resistor in the cathode.
Okay.
And he designed the circuit such that even though the cathode raised up, as the tube went on,
yep.
That was the output signal.
Mm-hmm.
And we also used a lower voltage swing than Bismack used. I think Bismack used 12 or 15 volts. I think we used 6 or 8 volts. I can't remember.
All right.
And that saved us power.
That
made the flip-flop more reliable because the cathode didn't have to rise as high and therefore risk unbalancing the flip-flop.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how that stuff comes back to you when you start to think about
exactly.
it.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's been a long time.
Right.
1950, we started in 54, I guess, on that thing.
Okay.
Yeah. And during the whole time that this was being engineered, we were in constant contact with both product planning and with the customer, social merchandise. They'd come, we'd have meetings and discussions and spec changes and requirement changes and all that crap.
Mm-hmm.
That
happened. Yep, exactly. Yep.
But it was a very challenging program because it was so new.
From the Archives is gathered from the audio holdings of the Computer History Museum. It is produced by curator Christopher J. Garcia. Music is by John Plute. For more information on this and other oral histories in our collection, please visit computerhistory.org. Thanks for listening to From the Archives.
This program was brought to you by the Computer History Museum.